Joshua chapter 3. Bless you. The new year is a really interesting time in our culture. It's characterized by people taking time out to focus on what things they would like to accomplish or achieve in the new year. How many of you guys make New Year's resolutions? Raise your hand so I can see. Raise your hand. Okay. Yeah, some people see this as a time where they will actually sit down and formally write out some of the things that they would like to accomplish or achieve going forward into the new year. Now, there's that group, but there's also a group that says, well, big deal. The earth made one revolution around the sun, and the new year is just another day on the calendar. If I wake up on a Tuesday in March and I decide I want to start eating right or start working out, I just do it. You know, some people just have that willpower and just can snap to it and just go out and knock out whatever goal that they desire to accomplish. Some people just have that type of willpower. How many people fall into that camp? All right. And then there may be a third camp, and I fall into this camp where I don't necessarily make New Year's resolutions, but I found over the past two Christmas holidays, it's given me some time to reflect back on the previous year, as well as think about what are some things that I would like to accomplish in the new year. And I think that has to do with over the holidays, my schedule kind of changes up and things slow down, which gives me an opportunity to take some time to think about, well, what is it that I would like to do? Because I'm not just thinking about what I need to make the kids for breakfast or what I need to get them ready for school. And just kind of breaking that routine allows me to have some focus beyond just what do I need to accomplish today. And so I'm in that camp. How many people are in the camp of, well, we don't necessarily make goals, New Year's resolutions, but we make goals. But whatever camp that you find yourself in, today I want to encourage and challenge you that as you look forward to these goals and things that you want to accomplish either in the new year or just in some point in the future, I want to encourage you to take some time to look back as you go forward. Look back as you go forward. There are things that have happened or there are things in the past that you can look back on that will benefit you and help you in accomplishing things that you want to do as you progress forward in your life. Now, notice I'm not saying go back and live in the past. You know, this is not one of those Al Bundy moments where you go back and celebrate that you scored four touchdowns in a high school football game, and that's the big achievement of your life. But I'm saying you're looking back to say, what are some things in the past that I can take and look at and benefit from as I go forward in life? There's a people group in the West African country of Ghana called the Akan people. And they have a word in their language called Sankofa. And Sankofa literally means that it is not taboo to go back and fetch what you forgot. And this principle teaches that you can reach back and gather the best of what your past has to teach you so that you can achieve your full potential as you move forward. So this idea of, they celebrate the idea of looking back to in order to look forward. But shout out to my Nubian brothers and sisters in Ghana. But they're not the only ones who embrace this concept of looking back to look forward. We also will see that concept here in our text today in Joshua chapter 3 and 4. And so let me provide a little context for where we're going. So the children of Israel, we know in the story, they were in captivity and enslaved in Egypt. And God delivered them from slavery and took them to the Red Sea and parted the Red Sea. And they made their way into the wilderness of Sinai. And God gave them the Ten Commandments and told them how they should relate to him. And God was started to head them on their way to march toward the promised land of Canaan. And as they took this couple days journey toward Canaan and they got right outside of Canaan, they sent 12 spies into the land to scout and do a reconnaissance mission on what Canaan entailed and what were the challenges that they were faced there. And the 12 spies came back, and there were 10 spies that came back with a very pessimistic report about what was in the land of Canaan. They did affirm that the land was indeed flowing with milk and honey. There were these huge grapes and great vegetation and fruit, and it would be a great place to grow crops and everything. But they also saw that there were giants in the land, and they felt like they were as small as grasshoppers in comparison to these people who lived in Canaan. And they also saw that the cities were fortified and that it would be very difficult to defeat the people who lived there already if they engaged them in military battle. And so 10 of the spies came back and said, you know what? It's not a good idea for us to go there. And only two spies said, no, regardless of the challenges, we still can go forward there. And this really upset God, and this rebellion upset God, because the people listened to the 10 pessimistic spies. And the people listening to the 10 pessimistic spies said, okay, God, we don't want to go to Canaan. We want to go back to Egypt. Now, how silly does that sound? They were an enslaved people. God had delivered them, but they were so afraid of what they were going to face that they were asking to go back to the position that they were in that was not very favorable to them. But there were only two spies that actually said, regardless of what we're facing in the land, let's go forward. And the names of those two spies were Joshua and Caleb. And so God punished the people who said they wanted to go back to Egypt and said, you guys will not get to inherit the promised land. And so their sentence was that they would have to wander around the wilderness for 40 years until all of the adults over the age of 20 died off. And then the people could try again to inherit the promised land. And so we pick up the story here in Joshua chapter 3, where the people now, after 40 years of wandering, are back now preparing to enter the promised land. So read with me in Joshua chapter 3. And we're going to read all of chapter 3 and all of chapter 4. Then Joshua rose early in the morning, and they set out from Shittim. And they came to the Jordan, he and all the people of Israel, and lodged there before they passed over. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people, as soon as you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God being carried by the Levitical priest, then you shall set out from your place and follow it. Yet there shall be a distance between you and it, about 2,000 cubits in length. Do not come near it, in order that you may know the way you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. And Joshua said to the priests, take up the Ark of the Covenant and pass on before the people. So they took up the Ark of the Covenant and went before the people. And the Lord said to Joshua, today I will exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. And as for you, command the priest who bear the Ark of the Covenant, when you come to the brink of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. And Joshua said to the people of Israel, come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God. And Joshua said, here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Perizzites, the Girgashites, the Amorites, and the Jebusites. Behold, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing over before you into the Jordan. Now, therefore, take 12 men from the tribes of Israel, from each tribe a man. And when the soles of the feet of the priest bearing the Ark of the Lord and the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand in one heap. So when the people set out from their tents to pass over the Jordan with the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant before the people, and as soon as those bearing the ark had come as far as the Jordan, and the feet of the priest bearing the ark were dipped in the brink of the water, now the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout the time of harvest. The waters coming down from above stood and rose up in a heap very far away at Adam, the city beside Zarethan. And those flowing down toward the Sea of Arabah, the Salt Sea, were completely cut off. And the people passed over opposite Jericho. Now the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firmly on what? Dry ground, in the midst of the Jordan. And all Israel was passing over the dry ground until the nation finished passing over the Jordan. Pause real quick. So we have this picture of the people of Israel. They have made it out of the wilderness and are about to cross the Jordan River, which is going to take them into the promised land. And God said, for the priest to take the Ark of the Covenant, which was a chest that carried the Ten Commandments, which was representative of God's law and his presence amongst the people. And he said, I want the priest to go out first. And when they go out first, they're going to walk into the middle of this river. And as soon as their feet touch the river is going to separate. And not only is it going to separate, but the ground is going to become dry. And I want you all to pay attention to where the priests are going, because you're going to follow them, but you're going to keep a distance from them. And so once the priests get into the water, then all of the people can pass across the Jordan on dry ground. And so so Joshua commanded them to do it. The people consecrated themselves, and they followed through with it. Let's pick it back up in chapter 4, verse 1. When all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, take 12 men from the people, from each tribe a man, and command them, saying, take 12 stones from here out of the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you, and lay them down in a place where you will lodge tonight. Then Joshua called 12 men from the people of Israel, whom he had appointed, a man from each tribe. And Joshua said to them, pass on before the ark of the Lord your God in the midst of the Jordan, and take up each of you a stone upon his shoulder, according to the number of tribes of the people of Israel. That is, that this may be a sign among you. When your children ask in time to come, what do these stones mean to you? Then you will tell them that the waters of the Jordan were cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it passed over the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. So these stones shall be to the people of Israel a memorial forever. And the people of Israel did just as Joshua commanded, and took up 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan, according to the number of tribes of people of Israel, just as the Lord told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to the place where they were lodged, and laid them there. And Joshua set up 12 stones in the midst of the Jordan, in the place where the feet of the priest bearing the Ark of the Covenant has stood, and they are there to this day. For the priest bearing the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord commanded Joshua to tell the people, according to all that Moses had commanded Joshua. The people passed over in haste. When all the people had finished passing over, the ark of the Lord and the priest passed over before the people. The sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh passed over armed before the people of Israel, as Moses had told them. About 40,000 ready for war passed over before the Lord for battle to the plains of Jericho. On that day, the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of Israel, and they stood in awe of him, just as they had stood in awe of Moses all the days of his life. And the Lord said to Joshua, command the priest bearing the ark of testimony to come up out of the Jordan. So Joshua commanded the priest, come up out of the Jordan. And when the priest bearing the ark of the covenant of the Lord came up from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priest's feet were lifted up on dry ground, the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed its banks as before. The people came out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month, and they had camped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in times to come, what do these stones mean? Then you shall let your children know, Israel passed over this Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over, so that all the people of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, and that you may fear the Lord your God forever. Ooh, that's a lot of reading. But it's a great story. So the people, after they crossed over the Jordan River, God commanded Joshua to tell them to choose 12 men to grab 12 stones out of the riverbed where the priests were standing. And so the men went back into the river where it was parted, where the priests were standing, and they grabbed 12 stones. I'm assuming they were pretty large because it said they bore them on their shoulders. And they brought those stones out, and they brought them with them to where they were camping for the night. And then Joshua set up these stones as a memorial for what God had done on that day. As we think of this, as we go start diving into this passage, I want you always to remember the concept of looking back. Going forward, you need to look back to go forward. Looking back to go forward. So the first thing I want to point out is, and draw your attention to, is the reality that you will face challenges as you pursue your goals in the future. You will face challenges as you pursue your goals in the future. In this particular passage, we see that the Israelites were going to face two specific challenges. The one that kind of jumps out in our mind after we've read all of that text is they had a challenge of trying to cross this river. Now, the Jordan River was not like the Platte River. It was actually a large river, and its banks were overflowing, and it was not the type of thing that most people could cross. Maybe if you had some kind of military background or really athletic, then you might have been able to swim across it. But for the most people who were in the camp of the Israelites, they were not going to be able to get from one side of the Jordan into Canaan by simply trying to wade or swim on this river. So they were at a place where they had a challenge of, how are we going to get from this side of the river into the promised land when we can't swim it and we can't wade in this thing? So that was the first challenge that they were facing. But there was also another challenge that they were facing, which God was using to use this particular miracle to help show them what he was going to do for them in the future. Look back in verse 9. We'll start at verse 9 in chapter 3. Verse 9 in chapter 3. And Joshua said to the people of Israel, "Come here and listen to the words of the Lord your God." And Joshua says, "Here is how you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, God was using this particular miracle of getting them from one side of the Jordan to the other to help to prepare them for the next challenge that they were about to face. The challenge, the bigger challenge, and the one in the future that they were about to face was they were going to try to take hold and take possession of this land. This is the land that God had promised them, but it was not a land that they were going to just walk in and inhabit without any challenges. So we know in the history that the first time some Israelite spies went into this land, they got spooked. And they got spooked so bad that they scared all of the people that they wanted to rebel and go back to Egypt. So this was not something that it was going to be an easy conquest. It was going to be something that they would be able to easily just walk into and everything was going to be okay. This was going to be a big challenge. And so God said, in order to show you that I'm going to take care of you when you go into Canaan and fight these battles, I'm going to do this thing for you now to help you see that I'm in control. And we see that God is in control in the language that he uses up here in verses 11 and 13. In chapter 3. And it says, "Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth is passing before you into the Jordan." And then skip down to verse 13, it says, "And when the soles of the feet of the priests bearing the ark of the Lord of all the earth shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan will be cut off from flowing, and the waters coming down from above shall stand still in one heap." We see God here is saying that, yes, you have a big challenge that you're going to face when you go into the future and try to inhabit the promised land. But it's okay because I'm greater than whatever challenge you're going to face. He says, "I'm the Lord of all the earth." And he repeats himself, "The Lord of all the earth is going to do this." And what he's saying by inference is that, yes, I'm the Lord of the earth, and I'll show you that by me controlling nature and allowing you to pass over from one side of the Jordan to the other on dry ground. But you need to know this as you go into Canaan and you start meeting confrontation from the people who are already in Canaan, the people with the fortified cities, the people who you view as being giants and larger that you won't be able to defeat. He's saying, "I am greater than the challenges that you're going to face." As you think about the things that may be on your New Year's resolution list, as you think about the things that you want to accomplish, maybe not just in 2014, but just going forward in life. Things like maybe you want to strengthen some relationships that are broken. Maybe you want to do some things for your health and exercising or eating better. Or maybe there's some things that you would like to accomplish on your job. Know that as you go forward, you will face challenges. I'm not a prophet. I know I might look like one. But I'm not a prophet. But I will guarantee you this, you will face challenges in the future. You're going to face challenges in the future. But the baseline understanding that you need to understand and know and hold true to is that God is greater than whatever your challenges are. God is greater than whatever challenges that you're going to face in this new year. God is greater than whatever strongholds that you have that have you writing the same New Year's resolution that you wrote last year and the year before. God is greater than any challenge that you're going to face in the future. The Lord of the earth, the King of the universe, is saying to the people of Israel that, yes, you're going to face some challenges, but it's okay. I am greater than your challenges, and I'm going to show you how. In the midst of God demonstrating his sovereignty and care over the people of Israel, he had them do something that's really the linchpin of what I want to talk about today. Let's read here in verse 4, chapter 1. We'll read 1 through 3 and skip down to 8 and then down to 19. Verse 4, chapter 1. When all the nation had finished passing over the Jordan, the Lord said to Joshua, take 12 men from the people, from each tribe of man, and command them, saying, take 12 stones from out here out in the midst of the Jordan, from the very place where the priest's feet stood firmly, and bring them over with you and lay them down in the place where you will lodge tonight. Drop down to verse 8, and it says, and the people of Israel did just as Joshua had commanded, and took up the 12 stones out of the midst of the Jordan, according to the number of tribes of the people of Israel, just as the Lord told Joshua. And they carried them over with them to the place where they had lodged and laid them down there. And let's skip down to verse 19. And the people came out of the Jordan on the 10th day of the first month and encamped at Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. And those 12 stones which they had taken, which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. So what did they do in the midst, and what did God have them do in the midst of him showing them that I will take care of you and I'm sovereign over all these things? He had them set up a memorial. He had them set up a memorial. And why did he have them set up this memorial? The text says that it's so that when their children come past and they see this thing and they ask, what is this thing about? What do these stones mean? And they're to tell them that this commemorates what God did for us on this day when he let us pass across the Jordan on dry ground. Now, why would you think would God have them build a memorial to commemorate what he did on that day? To talk to him. As a reminder, to remind them of what he had done, to give them a place that they could refer back to in what he had done. My favorite professor in school at Dallas Theological Seminary, his name is Dr. James Allman. He says it this way. He says, what God has done in the past is a model and a promise of what he'll do in the future. But he's creative, so he won't do it the same way twice. Let me say that again. What God has done in the past is a model and a promise of what he'll do in the future. But he's creative, so he won't do it the same way twice. In the midst of what God was doing, this just really blows my mind. And we look here in verse 21 in chapter 4, we see that God really representing this idea of, I'm showing you what I am doing now for the purpose of you to be able to remember what I did as you go forward. And as you continue to go forward, you can always look back and remember what I did for you. Let's look in verse 21, chapter 4. He says, and when the people of Israel, when your children ask their fathers in time to come, what do these stones mean? Then you shall let your children know Israel passed over the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over, as the Lord did to the Red Sea when he dried up for us until we passed over. That really, really blows my mind. So God is kind of moving on a couple of streams here. He's saying, I want you to set up a memorial to remember what I'm doing for you in the midst of this current circumstance. And so that you will know that I'm with you and I'm going to protect you. I want you to use this, and I'd use this whole miracle in the first place to help you to know that when you get to Canaan and you start facing these people and these fortified cities and have to go into battle to take conquest of the land, I want you to know, to be able to look back at this situation and say, well, God, you were with me when it was impossible for me to get from point A to point B. You were with me. You were sovereign over everything. You were interceding on my behalf so that I was able to get from this point A to point B that I could not get on my own. So now when you get into the future and you're fighting these battles against the Canaanites, the same God who was superseding over that situation is superseding over that situation. So God will be there in the future to do the same thing. But then what's cool about this is God didn't just look back at the situation of them crossing the Jordan. He took them back even to the Red Sea. And he said, now look, not only did I take care of you today, but this is consistently who I've been throughout your entire life. Many of the people here who were at the banks of the Jordan, they were mere children when they crossed the Red Sea. Some of them hadn't even been born yet. And so God is reminding them. He said, me taking care of you is not something new. I didn't just start, wake up one day and say, I'm going to look out for you and I'm going to take care of you. I did this for your daddy, and I did this for you maybe before you were even born. And you were in an equally impossible situation there at the Red Sea, where you had this huge sea in front of you and you had an army bearing down on your back. And what did I do for you in that situation? I saw you through. I delivered you. I took care of you. Step forward to this situation here. Again, you're in the middle. You're trying to cross the Jordan River, and you can't swim it, and you can't wade across it. What did I do? Similar to the Red Sea, I parted the waters, but I did it a little bit different way. What God has done in the past is a model and a promise of what he'll do in the future. But he's creative, so he won't do it the same way twice. And so now as they step into the future, and they begin to go into battle in Jericho and some of these other cities in Canaan, and they face themselves in equally impossible situations, what is it that God wants them to do? What is it that God wants them to do? He wants them to look back, to look forward. He wants them to look back and say, okay, God, I was in an impossible situation then at the Jordan River, and you took care of me. My folks were in an impossible situation when they were at the Red Sea, and you took care of me. So maybe I should take comfort and know that in this current situation that I'm in, facing this battle or these impossible numerical military forces, yes, I can trust that you will continue to take care of me. It's interesting to me that as God pointed them back to the past, that he pointed them back beyond just their current situation. I think one of the issues that we have in our culture is that we are very myopic, both in looking forward and looking back. We tend to look at our current situation and say, man, this is what my life is, and this is what my life is going to be, because that's how I was yesterday. And so when we look forward, we say, I don't see how anything could ever change, because it just seems like my life has always been that way. Never mind the fact that it's only been that way for a couple of days or maybe even a couple of months. You know, I think back to when I was single, and I used to wonder, I was like, bro, am I ever going to get married? I really don't know how this is all going to work out. And thinking about, you know, what life would be like, and maybe I was going to be a bachelor for my entire life. And now I stand before you today, and I've been married for 10 years. And hopefully in the next 10 years, I will be married for more time than I was actually single. And then after another 30 years, I'll be married for more time than I actually was on this earth. So it's like my life and the idea of what my life is more than just in my current circumstance. But we also have a problem of just looking back at what yesterday looked like, or just being very myopic about our past experiences. And so we'll say, well, how can I trust that God is going to be with me because my life was jacked up yesterday, or my life was jacked up last week? How can I trust that God is going to be with me? And we have a way of almost having amnesia and forgetting all the things that God has done for us, maybe in the past. Now, the past might not just simply be what happened yesterday. You might have to go back some years to reach back to say, well, what has God done for me? Because I haven't seen him move on my behalf in the recent past. God pointed these people back to the Red Sea when they crossed the Red Sea. There was a 40-year gap between them crossing the Red Sea and them crossing the Jordan. But God still pointed them back to say, look, I haven't changed. I was faithful to you back then. I'll still be faithful to you now. I know, and some of you may be saying, well, God has never done anything for me. And I say, well, let me just point you back all the way back to the cross. Jesus came, Jesus lived a perfect life, and Jesus died so that you can have a relationship with him. So if you can't think of any one thing, I can tell you one thing that Jesus did for you. And what God did for you is that he gave his life up so that you could be in relationship to him. And so if you're trying to figure out, say, man, I can't think of the last time God moved on my behalf. I can't think of the last time God superseded over a situation in my life. Your deepest need is to have a relationship with him. And God already took care of that. And so if you need something to look back in the past on, just look back on that. You guys mind if I kind of tell a little bit of my story and how this thing really impacts and affects me? This over the holidays, my wife instituted a ruling that, you know, I needed to finish unpacking all of these boxes that we have had packed up since we moved to Denver about 3 years ago. She was like, it's time. Either you get the stuff out the house, or I'm just gonna throw it away. So I heeded the mandate and started moving some of my boxes out of the way and actually started going through some of my old personal things that were still boxed up that I hadn't looked at in over 3 years. And so I'm a bit of a pack rat. So I save like old receipts and old files and all and things from my past. And so I started going through those things and trying to shred and figuring out what things are worth keeping and what things are worth throwing away. And so as I was going through it, it was kind of funny to me to see this file marked University of Alabama. And so I go back in it and I see all of these paperwork from the time when I was in college. And so I see my first resume. And on my first resume, I actually see where I was listing jobs of when I was in high school. And, you know, I still look very young, but my 20th year reunion is coming up this year in 2014. I know, shock, surprise, oh, yes, I'm actually that old. But I was looking back at that, and so I was kind of flipping through, and I saw offer letters for jobs that I had when I was in school, and then I saw an offer letter for a job that I had when I first graduated from school with IBM. And so before I became a pastor or whatever, I used to be a software consultant. And I used to travel around the nation and around the world, and it was just funny kind of looking back at some of those old receipts to see the places I had been, the places I had gone. And then I came across the folder that said March 1st. And March 1st is the name of the company that I left IBM for. So I worked for IBM for a year and a half, and then at that point, the tech market was really hot. A recruiter called me and said, am I interested in leaving IBM? And then we started talking about salary, and they pretty much said they'll double my salary. So I was like, yes, I'm very interested. And it was just so funny. I think I remember the conversation we had when we finally negotiated the final salary. I remember, like, my hand was shaking on the phone. I was really glad that we were over the phone because I kind of threw out a crazy number. And she was like, okay, that's fine. I was like, oh, Jesus. Help me. And so I left IBM. So this was October of 2000. And so at that time, I was living in Miami. And based on how much money I was going to be making, I was like, I need to get some kind of tax shelter. So I said, I'll move to Atlanta, and I'll buy a house in Atlanta. And so I took that offer letter and found a real estate agent and started looking for houses in Atlanta and actually found a house and put an offer on a house. And so I leave IBM, you know, this huge company, very safe, very stable for this internet startup called March 1st. And I go to orientation, which was in Chicago, Illinois, and I was at orientation for 1 week. When I got back from orientation on Monday, I get a call with a Chicago area code, and I'm expecting that to be my manager to tell me, okay, this is the first assignment or project we're gonna take you on. So I answer my phone, all happy and giddy. I'm in Miami, starting to think about what it's gonna be like to move to Atlanta in a couple months. And the person who calls me says, I regret to inform you that we're laying off your division. I was like, say what? Who? I was like, do y'all know I just left a cushy, comfortable job to come work for y'all? And I was like, I just got back from orientation. I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean laid off? I don't understand that. I was like, so what? And they were like, well, we'll call you back and let you know what to do. And they said, well, you might have to move to Chicago, which I was not interested in because I put an offer on the house in Atlanta. Or it was like, or you might just get laid off. And so I was like, wow. And I mean, I was just completely blown up. Again, I was just giddy about all this money I was about to make and this new opportunity. And here I am thinking my head is on the chopping block. And so maybe about the next day, I received a call from an Atlanta area code. And it was one of my former coworkers who I worked with at IBM. And he said, hey, man, are you looking for a job? And I was like, well, why, certainly I am. He was like, well, send me your resume, and I'll try to put you in for this company that I work for now and see what we can do. And so I was like, cool. So I sent him my information, and things started progressing forward, and I got a little bit less nervous about what was going to happen with March 1st because I had this new opportunity. But then progressed with this new opportunity, they said, well, we're about to have a hiring freeze because this is around the time when the dot-com bubble burst. And so jobs were starting to dry up. Companies were starting to not try to spend so much money. And so I'm like, man, what am I going to do? And I had already signed the contract on the house and had made preparations and had moved to Atlanta. And so I was in limbo with this one company just waiting for the day when they were going to call me and say, yes, you're laid off. And I'm in limbo waiting for this other company to say, yes, you can come on and start working. So I spent the entire month of January in a big old empty house in Atlanta, every morning checking my email, expecting to get email saying, you know, you've been laid off. And that email came, but that email came a week after I had accepted the position to go work for this new company. And so I'm looking at that situation and saying, wow, I will never forget how God took care of me through this situation. I'll never forget that I was completely out. This was my Red Sea. I was like, I'm going to get jammed up. I've already signed my life away to this big old house, and I don't know whether how long I'm going to keep this job, and I don't know whether I'm going to get another job. And God came through for me. Fast forward to 2009. In December 2009, Brandon Washington shows up at my doorstep and says, hey, man, I'm going to plant a church. I want you and your family to come up with me. At that point, I just graduated from maybe a year before I had graduated from seminary. And financially, things were looking kind of bleak. Had to pay for school, didn't take out any loans, so had some debt that I needed to go out and work to pay off. And here he is saying, hey, man, move to Denver. And I'm like, okay. And so my wife and I prayed about it and said, well, you know, this is what God is leading, so yes, we'll go. So we told him in January that we would go. Still didn't understand how we were going to get there. Was not making enough money to afford any kind of move, was not making enough money to find any kind of home here, but I was just trusting that, okay, well, this is the way God is leading. 3 months later, I get a call from a company offering me a position and saying that this is a one-year contract, and they're going to pay me really well. And I started doing the numbers, and I'm like, wow, I'll be able to pay off all of my debt from school. I'll be able to pay for the renovations for the condo that we live in order to put it on the market. And I'll have some money to be able to move here to Denver to get life established here. It was completely out of the blue. It was something that I knew I needed, but didn't know how to make it happen for myself. But then I thought back to what God had done when I was in this situation at March 1st. What God has done in the past is a model and a promise of what he'll do in the future. But he's creative, so he won't do it the same way twice. Fast forward to April of last year. We get a letter in the mail from our landlord. We were renting our house. We get a letter from the landlord saying, you guys need to move out in 60 days. Our contract, our lease agreement was up, and my landlord had decided he wanted to put the house on the market because he was tired of renting and just wanted to get out from under the property. And so he said, and I need you to prepare the house because I have some people coming over to view it, potentially to make an offer on the house. And in our mind, we were like, well, is there any way possible that we could potentially put an offer on the house? And he was like, well, we'll see. Let me let this guy come in and see if he likes the house. So here I am. I'm cleaning up, I'm vacuuming, getting the house spick and span, knowing that I'm cleaning this house up for somebody to come in and take it from me, effectively. But more so, where am I going to live in the next 60 days? Because it's just not really easy to find a house that quick. You know, for my family, we got all this stuff, we got to move. Don't have the money to have all the movers and everything. And I'm like, okay, I don't know how this situation is going to work out. We talked to the landlord on that Sunday, and he said, yeah, the visit went good, well with the guy. And I think he's going to make an offer on the house. We talked to the landlord on Monday, and he said, well, the guy really liked the house. He's like, but I think I want to sell the house to you. I don't know what changed his mind. I don't know what it was that made him decide that he wanted to sell the house to us. He wasn't a believer. There was not any kind of deep connection. We were cool, but there was nothing really that we could have done to make him open up and offer us the house. And after jumping through several hurdles, we were able to actually purchase the house in July. And so when I think about that situation, I go back to the situation that got us up here when I got that job in Minneapolis. And I go back to the situation in my life when I had got laid off from the one company and was hired by the other company. And I just continue to think that what God has done in the past is a model and a promise of what he'll do in the future. But he's creative, so he won't do it the same way twice. The idea of looking backward to go forward, you have to put some memorials. You have to write these things down. You need to keep some kind of note. It needs to be something that is prominent, something that you can easily refer back to, because as you go forward in the future, you're going to face challenges. You're going to face things and be in positions where like you're like, this is a roadblock. I have no idea how I'm going to get past this thing. But all you have to do is look back and see how God has been with you through all of those times. Look back and see how God has helped you and saw you through all of those impossible situations. And as you look back, that can give you confidence to go forward. Because the same God that was with you in those past situations is the same God that will be with you as you go forward. Last thing in the text, and I'm going to sit down. Two more things. When they created the memorial, the text says that the reason why they created this memorial was so that when the children saw it, they could ask what God had done. When we make these memorials, or when we think or present what God has done in the past, sometimes it's not just for your own benefit. Sometimes it's for the benefit of somebody else. You have no idea the encouragement that someone else needs as they're facing their battles and their challenges. And to hear your story and say, wow, if God will do that for you, maybe he'll do the same thing for me. And so this was a prominent thing. It wasn't just for them to remember. It was for their children to come by and see and say, well, what's the point of this? What does this all mean? And it meant that God was there for them. And it could be an encouragement to their children and to their children's children about who God was and how he acted on their behalf. So as you think about you creating these memorials and you creating these monuments to how God has taken care of you in the past, think about that it might not just be for you. It might be for the benefit of someone else. Last thing we see here in verse 25 is the ultimate reason why any of this even matters. And it says that the Lord, he dried up for us, he did into the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over, so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, and that you may fear the Lord your God forever. The point of all of this is not simply just to say, look what God will do for you. The point of it is to say, look who God is and look how great God is. Because of what God had done on their behalf, it should have pointed them to how mighty and strong God was. What God had done on their behalf also should have pointed to the other people who they would encounter, and they would also see how mighty and how strong God was. Too often times we get caught up in celebrating all the things that we get from God, and we miss the fact that it's beautiful and precious that God did it on our behalf. The relationship that we have with God is the important thing, not just the stuff, not just the miraculous things that he brings us through, not just the times he gets us out of jams or gets us out of impossible situations. Those are great, but all of those things should point us to him. Don't make too much of what he did for you that you miss him. God simply didn't die so that you could go to heaven. God died so that you could have him. These things that God had done and these memorials that he was pointing them back to was to point to not just simply that I will do these things on your behalf, but look who I am. Celebrate me. I'm worthy to be celebrated. And so as you reflect back on what God has done for you, you should look to him and point to him and say, wow, how mighty God is, how worthy he is of celebration. How grateful am I to be in relationship with him? How humbled am I to be in relationship with him? This God over all the earth will take care of everything. He supersedes over everything and yet desires to be in relationship with me. And that ought to bring about praise and thanksgiving and praise to God because of who God is. Looking back helps you to go forward. What God has done in the past is a model and a promise of what he'll do in the future. Remember, when God is coming through on your behalf this year, as you start checking off goals or checking off things that you have accomplished this year, resolutions or just things that you wanted to take care of for the year, write them down. Make a memorial for them, because there are other challenges that you will face. And as you face them, you'll be able to look back and say, wow, look at what God did. And so that I can trust that God will do those same things now. Let us pray. Father, we thank you that you're our eternal God. We thank you that you do not change. We thank you that your character is so trustworthy. We thank you for these stories of your mighty hand intervening on the behalf of your people. Let this be an encouragement to us as we go forward, that we can look back on the stories of how you intervene in the lives of the Israelites and others in the biblical text, and even how you intervene in our own lives and the lives of our parents and our ancestors, to know that the same God that was at work then is at work today and will be at work in the future. Encourage us, Lord, and really help us to go forward and face the challenges that we have for this new year with a sense of gratitude, with a sense of boldness, knowing that you are with us. We thank you, Lord, for all that you have done, but most important, we thank you for who you are, and we are so grateful that we are in relationship with you. Thank you for this time today in your word. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.